So, I've taken the task of trying to get you awake on the last talk of the day. Maybe my talk would have been better, a bit better before Richard's talk. What I'm trying to achieve is make you aware of the questions that arise when you distribute file systems. This has been tried many times, and many really smart people have attacked that problem from different ways, and there are simply hard questions that must be solved. And what I would like to do is make you aware of these questions and how typical file systems, Tom just mentioned them, solve these problems and how they attack that. Okay, skip that. By the way, I was the second one after Twitch to submit patches to Samba. Jeremy takes the famous role of being the first contributor to that project. And yeah. So, what questions does the designer of a distributed file system have to solve? Maybe the second bullet here is the most important one. Which semantics do the clients see? There are several ways to look at a file system. For example, do you have case-insensitive file names? Do you have different? Richard really talked in depth about the different locking semantics you will see. How is the caching being handled? How do you see current do you see the updates one client makes? When you have a wide area network in between, you don't want anybody immediately, or you don't want the client who actually writes a file have to wait for everybody across your enterprise to see the change. You want to, essentially you want to solve the caching problem. Essentially, how close is the coupling between the different nodes? Then, interesting question, we need some kind of access control, and the basis for access control is authentication. The file system needs to find out, okay, Volker Lendecke is really Volker Lendecke, whether he is allowed to access this particular file, that's a different question. But the basis for that is authentication. How do these different different file systems manage this task? Then caching, scalability. Scalability mainly is a result of the design decisions taken before, and I will try to look at what these systems do. First, I want to briefly introduce the four systems GFS, Global File System, as a placeholder for any block-based file system, GPFS being another one. There might be other ones around that coordinate block-based access from different nodes to a shared block device. Then the famous network file system, NFS, first being designed by Sun, now being designed by a broader community. Then the well-known CIFS, Common Internet File System, and the lesser-known Andrew file system. I'm going to briefly introduce them and go through the bullets here, authentication, access control, and so on. What is GFS? GFS is, I didn't fully translate these slides from German to English, obviously. I got a bit annoyed by the German spell checking in Star Office. I should have turned that on again, so... It's a cluster file system by Red Hat, bought initially by the company named Sistina. The basic idea of GFS is that you have a shared block device. However, you can share it. It's via a storage area network, via some kind of global network block device over TCP/IP. The essential point is you have multiple machines writing to the same block device at the same time. You have to coordinate that, and this is not always an easy task. They provide very close coupling, and they are very close to POSIX semantics in every respect. GFS can use various protocols. It can use a SAN backend. You can, however, also go and use TCP and UDP for different tasks. And one central thing to note is the GFS nodes are not protected against each other. Once you give a GFS node access to a block device. It is not object-based authentication or object-based authorization. Access to the shared block device gives you full access to all the data. Then, network file system, various versions. One of the earliest Unix network file system, version 2, being completely stateless. I'm going to talk about that a bit later. It's UDP-based because at the time when the NFS version 2 was designed, it was believed that TCP wasn't really up to the performance. The people chose the shortcut that UDP might be faster. Nowadays, you wouldn't do that because TCP has really caught up with performance. NFS doesn't provide any consistency across nodes. Slash home is divided. Slash home is shared among a bunch of machines. You don't really have coordination across them because when you look at it, slash home, you don't have a coordination problem. A typical user just logs into a single machine, and so a single machine can very well coordinate, provide consistency. It becomes hairy when you, for example, share vast pool mail, and then go and try to coordinate the consistency on that coming from different machines. There have been many improvements. TCP in version 3, they do have caching being coordinated. A client can ask, okay, please give me that file, and please notify when somebody else wants to access that file. I'm going to promise to write all my changes back. Version 4 is, I think, more than 200 pages, and as Trish really noted, when you read that, you get deja vus on every page. It's quite close from the semantics to SIFS. One thing to note is that they have yet another ECL definition. There are so many ECL definitions around. They invented yet another one. Then SIFS. Neither common nor internet, and not a file system. It's a protocol. My understanding of a file system, it's a format of the directory node on the disk, not the protocol. Okay, it started as a DOS file system calls redirected to the network, as we have heard this morning and at many events. It has expanded a lot. Nowadays, it's the transport for several other protocols, MSRPC being one of the most famous ones. It is a state-based protocol, and this, for scalability, is a problem. It's almost NTFS semantics on the net. Trish ran, when writing the POSIX VFS backend for Samba 4, he ran the IFS kit tester that Microsoft distributes for IFS or for file system writers, and he found that Windows 2003 provides different semantics when running over the network compared to when running on the local file system. So we could adapt Samba 4 to either the published over the net behavior, the behavior Windows 2003 publishes over the net, or what NTFS provides. So we're not yet finished on that, but I think the network behavior is the one to follow. So and then there's Andrew file system. It's probably the only one that really can be called distributed here, because this is the one that is designed from scratch to scale to very large environments. It comes from a Carnegie Mellon University. It was designed to support all the students 20 years ago with 20-year-old hardware from now. And you simply couldn't have 20,000 machines attacking a single server. It's a difficult task even now, but with hardware from 20 years ago, this was simply not possible. And what they did is from scratch, they designed the system so that you have to cope with many servers. And that's one way to achieve scalability. Design your system that there's a transparent failover, there's good handling for many file servers, for many whatever servers there are around. One point here is you have a central mount point under slash AFS. The Windows client says, okay, it's disk D or E or whatever, and you get the complete file space of maybe several terabytes under this one location. So the protocol can be designed in one of two ways, stateless and stateful. And there's a trade-off to choose from. The question is, do we have an open call? What does it mean? What does an open call really do? The client goes to the server and says, okay, I want to open this file for writing, for example. This open call typically contains a file name, maybe a directory name, or it is relative to a current directory or whatever, but it contains a file name, and what the server gets back to the client is a 16-bit or 32-bit or whatever handle. What this means is, why does it do that? Every time I want to read or I want to log or I want to write to the file, I don't have to transfer the whole file name. I can transfer this short optimized identifier. And this involves that the file server stores a table. Okay, identifier 1 is this file. Identifier 2 is that file. So the file server, being stateful, becomes a little more complex. The stateless server, yeah, probably less code. We don't have to maintain this kind of tables. But when not knowing what comes next, when there's no state, these kinds of optimizations are simply not possible. I would have, in theory, I would have to transfer, every time I write to the file, I would have to transfer the complete file name or an equivalent of that. And knowing the client's state, okay, this guy has opened this file for reading and for writing, I don't have to check every time. I have a handle on the file that he has opened, and I know, okay, this client is authorized. I'm sure that he's the same when trying to read from the file. I know he's authorized to read from the file. I don't really have to go through all that echo checking again. So this makes a lot of optimizations possible. Whereas, yeah, when you look at stateless protocols, it's very hard to do good authentication, because authentication usually involves that some kind of cryptographic interchange has to been performed, any kind of challenge response or Kerberos stuff, and getting these authorization tokens within each request, that's simply not possible. As long as you're really completely stateless. Next, when you're completely stateless, the client simply cannot tell the server, okay, I want to access this file for the next 10 minutes. Please allow me to cache my local, to cache it locally, and inform me when somebody else changes the file so I can invalidate my cache. When the server has no knowledge that this client has the file open, caching is simply not possible. That's where NFS v2 has these nasty hacks about asking the last modify time every minute or so. Any questions? By the way, any questions? Yeah, that's how NFS v2 does it. So, authentication. GFS and NFS v2, no authentication around. As I said, in GFS, that actually makes sense, because giving access to a storage area in a network, okay, this trusts the client machine. NFS v2 is a bit more difficult. Usually, there's many clients of NFS v2 around. The model of authentication here is that the client is trusted. The client operating is trusted to have authenticated user file. So the NFS client says, okay, this is user 500, and whatever permissions on the server this user 500 has are to be executed. CIFS, Common Internet File System, user-based authentication per server. And yeah, when the server goes down or I have to authenticate against a different server, the workstations have to re-authenticate. So there's some kind of caching of credentials. Windows Workstation actually cached the plaintext password nowadays, but Andrew Bartlett gave a talk on that. I always thought that they only cached the NT hashes, but apparently they do cache when you log in, Control-Alt-Delete, Volker-Lindeke, password ASDF. They cache the plaintext password, so to be able, when they have to re-authenticate against the server, they can provide the credentials. AFS, they use Kerberos 4, version 4, which is not the latest technology, but remember, this is 20 years old stuff. They are working on Kerberos 5. When looking at CIFS in a modern environment, we have Kerberos version 5. We still have to do fallback to NTLM. When you look at a SNF between a workstation, XP workstation, and a Windows 2003 server, it's very easy to make them fallback to NTLM just by not contacting the server name, but by contacting the IP address. The client requests a Kerberos token for the IP address. The server doesn't know the name for it, so it can't find the IP address as server name in its database. It says, okay, I don't know that guy. Workstation goes and does a fallback to NTLM. So we always have to fall back to NTLM. NFS v4, potentially Kerberos 5, as latest versions of AFS also do Kerberos 5. Access control. This is not really a protocol issue. It's more or less an implementation feature. To specify who can access what is, yeah, Windows admins like their model, POSIX admins like their model, and you have to find some kind of mapping to, yeah, really make them agree on a common model. GFS, NFS v2 and v3 are strictly POSIX-based, user group others, and list of users and groups, having read, write, and execute bits. This is the basic POSIX model. NFS v4 probably can be made compatible to this pure POSIX model. When you look at the RFC, this is one of the areas where you really get this deja vu. It's really modeled along the Windows ECL model, but it's not quite, so we still have to, when Samba will run over NFS v4 server, Samba is an NFS v4 client, we will have to provide a mapping layer because it's not absolutely, I didn't really look where the real differences are, but Jeremy can probably tell you a bit more about that in detail. SIFS and Windows, SIFS running on Windows, it's a complex set of ECLs, and the problem with these is that many Windows admins don't really know what's going on in their networks, because Windows provides the feature you can delegate the possibility to manage ECLs to one of your project managers who takes care of his own directory. So the IT department, when I go to IT departments, the first question really is, okay, do you have documentation on your ECLs? And most of them don't, because they got rid of the task by giving the permission to manage permissions to other people. So there's no documentation. They have complex ECLs. Most of the people don't really know what's going on their file servers. SIFS, using running Samba on Samba 3, we are completely bound to the POSIX model. This is a decision Samba 3 always has seen itself as really being a good Unix guy. So we always need a Unix user ID and Unix group IDs to let the kernel give us permission denied and not to do it ourselves. Samba 4, as you see on the slide, has implemented the NT model. Trish has told you about that. It's this right after lunch. I don't think Samba 4 will ship without having POSIX ECLs also available, the very same mapping as Samba 3 does. So I would see it as an option, so you can choose probably on a per-share basis which kind of access model you want. Then AFS has its own model. You have to get used to that a bit, but when you really, really administer it for a while, it's quite a sane model. You have ECLs on a directory basis. You have 7 models, and AFS actually solves the POSIX problem that you also here can delegate the ability to really manage ECLs. So you can get a group manager to manage his own directories, which is not possible in POSIX. Locking. The last talk really showed this is a hard problem. What is locking as such? It's a means to get exclusive access to any resource. Okay, I want to maintain this table. I want to add an entry to that table. There's 2 things. I actually have to add the entry, and somehow I have to say, okay, there's 1 entry more. 2 fields in a database, for example. I can't do one without doing the other. So these are 2 operations. I have to do them in sequence. I have to get them right. So in between, I need to get a handle on the complete table. And this is done by different kinds of locking mechanisms. So there's some questions to answer. What is the entity I want to lock? First, okay, I can get hold of a complete file. Windows calls the share modes. This is one aspect that Richard has implemented. A client can say, okay, oh, whoever has tried to backup an NT workstation sees, okay, the registry file is being locked. That's exactly the problems you face when somebody can exclusively get hold of a complete file. Unix explicitly does not do it. Imagine what happens if somebody simply logs, edits the password. Nobody can do an ls-l decently anymore. Windows does it. DOS applications and Windows applications depend on these complete file logs. Then, on a finer grained basis, I can have byte range logs. These are, okay, I want to have byte 1 and 2 of this file exclusively for me. This essentially is a way to do inter-process communication. This model, okay, I want to update that table, two steps, I need to completely lock the table. It's for me, and then I free the log, and others can read what I've done. There's different ideas between Windows and POSIX about advisory and mandatory logs. POSIX usually does not do mandatory logs, so processes are expected to cooperate on a shared resource. So when somebody wants to update a file, it is expected that this process first asks, okay, may I update this file, and then be polite, and only when he is given permission to update the file. Windows behaves a bit differently. They, by default, have mandatory logs. A process locks the file for himself, and nobody else really can read and write that file. It's a different view. Mandatory logs have several problems. As I said, okay, you can't update the registry. You can't back up the registry. Windows shares modes have quite a complex set of rules to allow and deny access to files based on the logs that already are existing on the file, and partly, depending on the type of log you want, it also is based on the file name, would you believe it? Also, byte range locks are completely different between POSIX and Windows. One set of problems is POSIX normally only has 31-bit locking range, so you can only lock the area between 0 and 2 gigabytes. On 64-bit systems, it's the lower 63 bits of area because the integer you tell the kernel, okay, I want to lock offset X, that's a signed integer, so you lose one bit in the range. Windows is different. We have the full 32 or 64-bit range. And as Richard told, overlapping locks are handled differently. How do the different file systems implement locking? GFS, as closely coupled file system, does the full POSIX locking. They have no per-file locking. As I see from the white papers, I didn't actually test that. They have advisory byte range locks. As I said, full POSIX. CIFS does the Windows-compatible locking on the wire. I'm not entirely certain about the mapping of the API calls, of the Win32 API calls, compared to what arrives on the net. But the CIFS is quite compatible to what the Win32 API actually does. When using CIFS against Samba, Jeremy is in the process of implementing POSIX-compatible locking on top of CIFS. CIFS has one big advantage. It's such a huge protocol, you can hide anything in there. We have actually been given a set of requests for Microsoft that Microsoft has promised us not to use. We are trying to make use of this for our own extensions, POSIX compatible locking being one of those. NFSV2, no locking. You can add the lockd for doing locking on with a separate protocol. It's not part of NFSV2 at the core. NFSV4 tries to do both complete file and byte range locking, but when you look at the NFSV4's RFC, there is the assumption that byte range locks are very rare, and this might not always be the case, that this assumption actually holds, because Windows applications, Unix applications completely behave differently, and this is an important topic when you have to look at when choosing a file system, when doing tuning. You really have to look at the workload. If this kind of assumptions, okay, we expect a locking request for every 100 read or every 100 write requests, it might actually turn out that the reverse is true. Applications only do locking, and due to oplocks, do local caching and whatever. Oplocks, I don't have to put lockings to the server, but you actually have to look at what goes on the net to really make the decision whether this kind of assumptions actually hold true. AFS, it's made for a huge number of servers. AFS is made for wide area networking, and one thing you cannot afford in this kind of environment is to depend on too many round trips between the client and the server. So what they do is, the best you can do with AFS is lock a complete file. What you would not do is just go do bind rate locking, because this has the potential to really beat the server, and AFS is the system. When you look at this list here, GFS is closest, SIFSF and NFS are similar, and AFS is the one that is very remote and has very good scalability properties. So they don't simply say, okay, we can't do byte range locking over the network efficiently, so why do it at all? Applications should use other mechanisms. In fact, AFS has a separate permission. This user is allowed to lock a file, because this is an operation that potentially is expensive network-wise. Caching. GFS doesn't really do decent caching because it can't. It assumes very low latency to the hard disk. NFS v2, as I said, no coordination. Heuristics. SIFS, NFS v3 and 4, and AFS, they delegate the permission to cache files, not to update immediately, not to update with write request immediately, to assume, okay, I've read that area of the file, and the server will inform me when somebody else updates this. So this is necessary to do good caching. So not every operation read the file again and again. The server doesn't need to be informed when he has given me the permission to really cache this file. The AFS implementation, okay, another typo, goes one step further. When you reboot the client, based on a version ID, the cache even works on disk. This is an implementation issue. Other file systems could do that as well, but AFS is really strong in, okay, you reboot the client and your /user/bin doesn't have to be transferred again when you reboot, when you start up the machine, and Netscape is already on your local disk. So when looking at it from a bit above, we have to ask ourselves, okay, do we really need the idea of local semantics? How can we achieve it, and how does it affect scalability? With local semantics, I mean, okay, you have a file server, no network involved. How does this file server treat atomic operations like, okay, I want to create a file system call, two clients do that at the same time. What's the real idea? Does one fully succeed? What kind of error message does the other get? Then there's the byte range logs, F control logs. How are they really handled, and how are they handled efficiently? Then one very interesting issue, memory mapped files. Are they coherently handled between, okay, I read and write, or in particular, I write to a file using a normal write system calls. Other processes have mmapped this file. What is the latency between the writing process and the other one seeing the changed file contents in the in the main memory mapped? This is really an important questions you have to ask. Then this all this really affects scalability. When you want a scalable system, all you need to do is really do as little communication as possible on the network, because every request really hurts performance. It must not always be the pure data, the raw data, amount of data that is being transferred. What in many cases really hurts you more is the latencies, the round trips. What you have to then accept is some kind of inconsistencies. But when you know about these inconsistencies, you can plan your application for it. For example, we will see AFS doesn't update files unless they are closed. So I open a file, I write to that file, and nobody else sees my changes until I close the file. But then, all is atomic. This has advantages, it has disadvantages, but as long as you know about it, you can design your applications around that. And as I said, latencies here often are much more important than the raw data that is being transferred between a client and a server. There are several ways to achieve scalability. First, I can make a single machine larger. The chip industry has provided very good ways to do this, but especially when you have wide area networks involved, this comes to an end somehow. So you have to find ways to distribute your load over several machines. There are several ways to do it. For example, a protocol like HTTP is very easy to scale because there's this, essentially HTTP is sort of stateless. When I do some kind of eBay transaction, this is not entirely true anymore, but the basic model of the protocol is that it's stateless. For every single picture I get from the eBay website, I get a single request, and this is very easily distributable using IP-based load balancers and put up any number of farm, any number of servers behind that. The other way to really get scalability is to redirect clients, to explicitly redirect clients. With HTTP, we have the model, okay, the client essentially is dumb. It connects to a single IP address, and then some intelligence there says, okay, this request actually has to go to that server, that server, that server. What is even better is that the server can tell the client, okay, the data you want to request is not located here, but go there. So no IP redirects involved. But this requires protocol support. And the different protocols involved, GFS and so on, handle it differently. GFS, there's no way. There is no master and there is no server and client. But GFS, when you look at the white paper, I haven't really seen any large installation myself. I've played around with it a bit, but no large installations. They say, okay, they can do up to 300 clients. NFS and SIFS are made for single servers, and this essentially inherently gives limits. It's a matter of the server can scale to really large amounts. Modern versions of both NFS and SIFS can redirect clients. Microsoft calls this MSDFS. A server can say, okay, this file is not handled here, go there. And the client workstation actually sees it, but the client application and the user doesn't see that the client is being redirected. The implementation Microsoft has chosen makes it a bit problematic because client applications see that as this information, okay, that directory isn't on that server, but it's there. This is extremely static, and the model Microsoft chose is that this is per machine specific. For example, you can't go and install a terminal server as a client of a MSDFS root and go per user. This user has his home directory there, and that user has his home directory somewhere else. This is a per machine thing. When this directory is somewhere else, this is per machine, not per user. It's a bit of a disadvantage, but it works quite well. NFS v4 has similar capabilities. It can say, okay, this file isn't here, go somewhere else. This gives you really, really good scalability. This, however, for having scalability, statelessness is a very good thing. Every request is individual, so there's ways to have stateless NFS servers around that can be load balanced. Real load balancing in the IP sense, okay, the thing that the big web farms do, have a single IP address, a single port being farmed out to any number of servers. That's a bit difficult to achieve with SIFS. Richard can really tell a long story about that because there's too much state involved to get across the different nodes. That's really a hard task that has been covered many times during the SIFS conferences in San Jose and California. There was one talk that was actually the title, SIFS clustering is hard. That's the title of the talk. AFS. This is sort of an AFS advertisement slide. The best thing I see is this here, it's the fifth one. Because AFS is designed to really handle many servers, there are ways that you can go and really replicate your data and move your data from one server to the next one while being accessed by clients. No client application will ever see that this data has moved. And this is really good for big server farms where one server, okay, this RAID has a degraded disk or whatever, I decide not to pull out the disk and replace it. I want to upgrade the complete server. I want to take it off the net. I move data away with a single command and can shut down the server, and nobody really notices. Okay, it assumes that you have still room on your disk, but that's the best thing with AFS scalability. So, coming to a conclusion, what should I choose? Again, shared file systems, that's a difficult task. This question is equally difficult to answer. What you really need to do is look closely at what your environment wants. Do you need the close coupling GFS provides? For many applications, I sort of doubt it. There might be some that it's really necessary. High-performance clusters might be one of those that they really make use of GFS. But otherwise, you really need to ask yourself, do I need this read-write and mmap consistency across nodes? Do I really need the locking across nodes? When I make use of it, is it really performing well? Yeah, that's a different trade-off. You have to make your choice on. Do you have Windows clients around? High-performance clusters often don't. When you have Windows clients around, there's one real advice and probably Novell has also learned from hard practice. Don't touch the clients, because Microsoft can really break it with every service pack. So this is where Samba comes in. Do you have a wide area network involved? GFS doesn't like that at all. The current only real solution I see when real wide area networks are involved is AFS. But AFS as such, it's made for many servers, but AFS is no fun when you want to set up the first three servers. When you have the 50th server, then it's fun, but the first three servers, that's a bit of a challenge. Next problem, I have my 5,000 Linux clients, how do I share their home? Traditional is NFS, but there's a good talk by Olaf Kirch, no file security, need 50 sysadmins and all that stuff. NFS isn't really a solution for large environments, in particular because of we rely on the client operating system to authenticate users, at least not when not making use of NFS before. AFS has per-user credentials, Kerberos version 4, but it's for many environments, as I said, it's too complex to set up. And this is where we, as Samba team, would like to provide at least an alternative. You have your Samba server, you have your Samba domain controller around, you have to take care of your Windows clients, and now a department comes in, okay, I have my 50 or whatever, I have my 100 machines I want to transfer to Linux. So why not take a close look and look at SIF's file system and Samba as a server. There's going to be extensions to make that more POSIX compatible. There's going to be extensions to Samba and WinBind to make that easier to set up. So no need for NSS LDAP. I think that's really a viable alternative in the field of remote file systems. There's no silver bullet, but you might want to look at that. Yeah.
That's what we're talking about tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Any questions? The question was: is it possible to have the best of both worlds, Samba and AFS? Yes, there is. I've done a lot of work in exactly that area to make Samba a file server with AFS in the back end. Sven, stand up, whatever. I don't know. Yeah, there's the Stonehenge people in Mainz who actually sponsor a lot of that. That is a very good alternative. It's not really easy to set up and to monitor, but that's where other people come in and help you. But this is a real, from my point of view, okay, I've done a lot of that, but from my point of view, that's really a scalable alternative. Yep. It's more the latter, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question was, do application vendors actually test against this kind of environment with complex setups? I very much doubt it, because they don't simply have the setup around. And there's no incentive. It works against NTFS. And that's where the complete coverage or a micro-trich one or the Samba 4 people want to achieve with Samba get really 100% of protocol coverage so that we can really make sure, okay, if it fails against Samba, then we are very certain that it also fails against Windows. And this is essentially the test for Samba, the main test for Samba. Any other questions? Yeah.
Is there a way that this AFS backend and Samba do that without green button and without green text button?
Yes, certainly. That's the question was, is there any way to have AFS backend and Samba frontend without WinBind and plain text passwords? What do we have against WinBind? The point is, you have to make sure, you can always replace WinBind with local user databases or NIS or whatever distributed user databases. But that's exactly the kind of work I've done. I got rid of the necessity to use plain text passwords when having a backend, AFS backend. Okay, you have to make a compromise. You have to give Samba your server key. So that Samba can create Kerberos tokens on its own. Not all are willing to do that, but there's no good alternative. Either plain text passwords, Windows client to Samba server. The other alternative is trust the Samba server to actually authenticate your users decently and create let that one create the token for you. There's no other way. Any other questions? Yeah? Yeah. No, you're looking at a different thing. The question is GFS really only scalable through 300 clients? The talk tomorrow is talking, I think, about at most two or three GFS clients as such. On these GFS clients that talk directly to the block device, you can install Samba servers that can serve any amount of Windows users. I was talking about the GFS nodes directly talking to the block device. And as this is so closely coupled, I don't believe that it really scales to 300. I think it's made for more like 10 or 20 or maybe 50 nodes accessing the same block device. Any questions? Okay, then thanks for your attention. And probably we will see in half an hour or what, in 20 minutes, at the hotel reception together for the bus transfer to the party. Okay.